Eric, this is David John Thomas, please, again, Bruce, please, Martin, Adam, Nelson, Timmer, James, Lewis, Keith, Helen, Bernard, Fisher, City Attorney, Wayne, Rayner, Chief Deputy, City Attorney, Heather, A. Waller, Deputy, City Attorney, D. Helen.
You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and I should note at the beginning that it's a little disconcerting that as soon as my case is called, a dozen State Bar presidents get up and walk out of the room on me. I will try to soldier on despite the sting of this. In this appeal, as you've noted, we represent the widow of the man who was killed while the police recruit during the training process. I'll emphasize what I think is fairly clear from the briefs, but it's important to note it as well. I am not asking you in this case today to rule that the death in this case was due to repetitive traumas. I'm asking you to rule that a jury has to decide that question. The trial court took that question for itself, and that was the mistake that it made in this case. On the briefs, the defendants have now chosen to narrow their defense to the language that we quote on page 1 of the reply brief, where they point out that the issue, in their view, is not whether the injury suffered on December 9 was the cause of death, but whether it was a cause of death. We took that from page 10 of their brief, and they said the same thing on page 6. So that emphatically is a position that they're staking out here. This is a new legal position. It's one taken for the first time at this stage of the case. It was never raised below. It was not raised at the petition stage. In this situation, in reviewing the cases to prepare for today's argument, I decided to go back and look at the primary cases that the parties have cited on repetitive trauma, find out whether they did say the cause or a cause. And the results are unanimous. I can just count them about 45 to 60 seconds. In the Astrop versus Blue Diamond case from 1943, the court held that the cumulative effect of many acts done, quote, no one of which can be identified as the cause of the harm, is not within the act. That's 181 Virginia at page 293. In the Lane Company versus Saunders in 1985, the court ruled that injury by accident requires a showing of an identifiable incident that, quote, is the cause of an obvious sudden mechanical or structural change. That's 229 Virginia at page 199. And finally, in 1989, in the Morris versus Morris trilogy of cases, the court ruled, and I quote, a claimant must prove that the cause of his injury was an identifiable incident, and so forth and so on. That's page 238 Virginia at page 589. The defendants, accordingly, have elected to plant their flag on indefensible ground. They're asking this court either to make a sea change or simply ignore all of those prior decisions. The court will note that in the two places in their briefs where they do make this claim, pages 6 and 10, no supporting cases are cited for the proposition that a cause is the proper standard. The defendants, accordingly, ask this court to change the burden of proof in comp bar cases from the cause to a cause. They offer no legal support for this change. They cite no case law or treatises. They offer no principled reason to make this change other than the fact, presumably, that they want to win this appeal. The request for the sea change doesn't end there. They also, as we noted, implicate a broader issue of whether trial courts can take away from juries disputed fact issues once those facts have been set up by the pleadings. When we alleged, as we do, multiple traumas as the cause of death, and they deny that, the parties are therefore at issue on this point, and that becomes a question for a jury. This is emphatically a fact matter, not a question of law. The defendant's discovery request, which the trial court pointed to as somehow being dispositive, identified 2 days on which traumas were suffered, made no reference to the other 78 days of training during which the training was ongoing, and we've alleged that there were other traumas. Those don't remove all factual disputes from the case, which, of course, is the standard for granting summary judgment. There can no longer be any disputed material fact. We still allege multiple traumas over many days. They still deny it, and that's why we convene juries.
Mr. Emmert, as a practical matter, I understand the distinction you're making. Focusing on a jury deciding this as opposed to a question of law here. Also understand the question of law you've just isolated that would have to be, in your judgment, changed in order to hold for the appellees. As a practical matter, Would there have to be interrogatories to a jury to determine the answer to that question in the context of a verdict, or would there be a preliminary proceeding prior to a trial? How would it work?
In this case, the trial judge had directed that there would be a bifurcated trial, that the jury would first be directed to undertake the question of whether the injury was by accident. And if the jury ruled in favor of the plaintiff on that, then there would be a separate trial on liability. Theoretically, in other cases, you could do it by special interrogatories to the jury. You could do it by instructions to them, telling them that if you find that this injury was due to a sudden identifiable accident and so forth, then you shall return your verdict for the defense, and it becomes a comp bar case. But in this case, the trial judge has already taken care of that question by order.
If we were in a position of having this separate proceeding, I wonder about the slippery slope. I wonder how many cases would then subsequently fall into a separate proceeding allowing a jury to determine whether or not there is an identifiable cause, which could be considered an accident, or whether they fall into the category that you would like them all to be in. How do you respond to that?
I'm not in a position to know how many cases there would be, except for the fact that I can tell you that in the jurisprudence of this court, repetitive trauma cases are quite scarce. You know that we've each cited really only three of them. I don't know how often a factual dispute such as this will arise in the context of whether an injury is due to repetitive trauma, for example, or is due to an identifiable incident. So I don't know. I would be speculating to answer Your Honor's question, and I hesitate to do that.
This case, I mean, this was originally a plea and bar, right?
Correct.
You know, and that was
decided on that basis.
Okay. But there was no evidentiary hearing.
Correct.
On the plea and bar. It ended up being called a motion for summary judgment. There was a separate motion for summary judgment.
Correct.
I've got the appendix here open, but was there an initial denial of the plea and bar, and then after discovery and requests for admissions were submitted, the summary judgment motion came along?
You're exactly right.
Okay.
Originally, the trial judge decreed that there would be no summary judgment, that the case would go on to two jury trials, effectively, a bifurcated proceeding. And then after receiving these requests for admission responses, the court changed its course and granted summary judgment.
You could have a jury on a plea and bar if it was requested.
Absolutely. The City of Bethel versus City of Bethel Investment versus City of Hampton stands for that quite well.
Go ahead.
I thought that was the posture of this case. I thought what had happened in the case was they filed their answer, and along with their answer, they filed a plea and bar. They asked for a hearing on the plea and bar, and you asked for a jury on the plea and bar.
That's correct.
And that's where we are. So it wasn't really bifurcating the trial. It was a hearing on the plea and bar, which would include a jury.
As the posture of the case is, you've set it out correctly, Your Honor, before the summary judgment hearing in this case, the trial judge had previously entered an order over our objection, but entered an order saying that there will be two separate juries, one to consider the issues raised by the plea and bar, the fact issues, and the other to consider, if necessary, the question of damages and liability and so forth.
And then the motion for summary judgment is basically on the plea and bar, and my understanding of the position of the city is that there are no material facts in dispute concerning the workers' compensation issue, and therefore we do not have to have a jury on that. So it was a motion for summary judgment, but it was basically underpinned by the plea and bar.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And then they did indeed insist that there were no factual disputes. We
urged
the trial court to rule that there was a factual dispute based upon our pleading and their denial of whether it was cumulative trauma.
Consider a carpal tunnel case for this moment. Assume that repetitive injury is attributed to a carpal tunnel syndrome, but then there is an identifiable incident that occurs. Under your scenario, that case would go to a jury on a plea and bar to determine whether or not this was one carpal tunnel syndrome case or whether it was an identifiable injury that would suffice as an accident for the workers' compensation bar. Am I right?
I believe you are right, Your Honor. Because carpal tunnel syndrome ordinarily is a repetitive trauma. You knit a certain way or you type a certain way over and over and over again. But it also, as I know quite well, can result from a sudden traumatic injury. And if the question then becomes, which of these two was the cause, and the parties dispute that, then I think that is resolved by the jury. That's correct.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? Let's say that we have changed the facts just slightly, or maybe not even change them. We have two separate flows, all within the period of the person's employment, all covered by the same carrier, all would be handled the same way if it was a workers' comp case. Is it your position that if the evidence is that one or both of those blows were the sole cause of the injury, that that would not be an injury by accident? Because we can't tell which exact one it was.
But as you phrased it, I think the answer to the question is it would be, but I think I need to clarify my understanding of your question. If you have two incidents, either of which could have caused, but we don't know which one, then I think that does present a question for a jury on whether it was an injury by accident, because we can't identify a specific time. In the Morris case, for example, you got rid of the three-hour rule. And in this situation, if we have multiple traumas, in this case it was many more than two, but just two traumas, and you don't know which one caused it, and they're separated by days, then I think that it does become an issue for a jury in that situation.
And you... contention would be there would be a cumulative injury that would not be an injury by accident. What would be the rationale for that not to be covered under workers' comp?
Well, the rationale is basically the case law that this court has handed down saying that cumulative traumas are not covered. The Morris case specifically did refer to repetitive traumas, not just continuous exposure to conditions such as gases and things like that.
Well, wasn't the problem in the Morris cases is that they couldn't show an identifiable injury?
That's one of the problems, yes, Your Honor. That's correct. May I have leave to respond in the time remaining?
Sure. Thank you. Okay. You may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, my name is Wayne Ringer. I'm the Chief Deputy City Attorney for the City of Norfolk. With me here and on brief are Deputy City Attorney Heather Mullen, and we represent the appellees in this case, Officer Sapp, Bailey, Reardon, Tessier, and former Chiefs Chamberlain and Marquis. Justice Lemons, you asked Mr. Emmert a question that I think nails part of the issues in this case, which is if you had a carpal tunnel syndrome that might have developed over time, but you then had an injury by accident that caused it, would that present the same jury trial issue that he advances in this case? And he says, yes, and I say categorically no. The long line of jurisprudence in this case on injury by accident is that no matter how the claimant comes to work on the day of the injury, whether he's a person that has a previous injury that is made worse by the injury on the day of the accident, whether he has a pre-existing condition that is aggravated or accelerated or exacerbated by an injury by accident, whether he has something about him that leaves him predisposed to an injury, none of that makes any difference to the analysis of the day of the accident, what happened, was there an injury by accident. And in all of those circumstances, the court and the entire jurisprudence of the Workers' Compensation Act has been that if there is an identifiable injury by accident that creates a sudden, obvious mechanical or structural change in the person's body, regardless of what their previous condition was, regardless of whether they had a pre-existing condition, regardless of whether they were predisposed, because the event that precipitates it is an injury by accident, it's compensable under the Workers' Compensation Act.
Well, that's the VEPCO case.
It is.
Because there the lady, if I recall correctly, had probably pre-existing aneurysm. But we said in that case that because the event that day was the failure to give her timely medical care, and that was an aggravation. The injury that day was the aggravation of the pre-existing aneurysm.
Yes.
And we said that was an injury by accident.
Correct.
So when you've got a situation like this where you've got a dispute as to whether what happened on, I think, December 9th caused the subsequent hemorrhage and injuries that this man sustained, or whether it was a result of the blows to the head that occurred over, you know, several days, why isn't that a disputed fact? Because doesn't it come down, are we really arguing about causation? And I think Mr. Emmert's right. You've narrowed the issue down as to whether the case law requires it to be a cause or the cause. And I think you've argued that it has to be, if it's a cause, then it's an injury by accident. And I'd like for you to square that position with the language that Mr. Emmert quoted out of ASTROP, and that's been repeated several times in our cases, and that language specifically is that when an injury on gradual growth, not the result of some particular piece of work done or condition encountered on a definite occasion, but caused by the cumulative effect of many acts done and many exposures to conditions, no one of which can be identified as the cause. It doesn't say a cause, and we talk about the cause on multiple cases. Then why isn't the question whether the disputed fact here as to whether what happened on the 9th of December was the cause or a cause of this man's injury? Well, if it's the cause, it's an injury by accident, and if it was a cause, it's not.
There's a difference, and it runs through the discussion in the trial court and in my brief here, between the injury by accident of December 9 and what it caused, and the cause of death that occurred 9 days later. And he does accurately quote from my brief, but at the end of my brief, I say, to conclude that the head blows on December 9 were not the precipitating cause of injury and death would be strained, forced, and contrary to reason, which is the language from the Bloodworth against Ellis case. And so I think it is correct, but if I'm wrong, you'll tell me that where there's an injury by accident on the 9th of December that put him in the hospital after he collapsed in a training exercise while being hit in the head, that is a workers' compensation injury by accident.
Is it because it was a cause or the cause?
Well, it's both.
You argued in your brief, if I understand it correctly, that as long as it is a cause, that's good enough for an injury by accident.
It's the precipitating cause.
No, that's not what the case law says. It talks about the cause, and you argued in your brief a cause versus the cause.
If in any case in which a person suffers an injury by accident, especially if it's a case of a person with a pre-existing condition, like Combs, like any of the other cases of that kind, whatever the eventual outcome for the worker is, has a number of causes. It has the injury by accident, and it also has that person's history. A person that did not have that pre-existing condition might not have suffered that injury by accident and might not have suffered the sequel. But all I mean to be saying is that every person comes to us as they are, and when they suffer an injury by accident, that's the precipitating cause of what happens to them thereafter. But it doesn't exclude that there may have been other things in the past.
Well, no question about that, but why aren't they entitled, if they dispute whether what happened on the 9th was the precipitating cause, to use your words, and they dispute that, and they pled that, why don't they get to have a jury trial on that?
Because we think the facts that they admitted in discovery establish that issue conclusively without the need for a jury trial.
And what are those facts that you claim they admitted that establishes this was the precipitating cause?
They are mainly found in the plaintiff's responses to our request for admission number 8.
What page is the...
That's on page 37 of the appendix. Begins near the bottom of page 37 and runs into page 38. This is a request in which we had asked him to admit that while in the defensive tactics training exercise of Officer Sapp on the 9th of December, that he was injured. And if you read the entire response, you see that they take issue with the word injured and contend that they do not know what it means because it's a term of art, but they do admit facts. And the facts that they admit is, it is admitted that the medical record indicates that Mr. Kahn arrived at the hospital on the 9th of December, something after 5 p.m. It is likewise admitted that he was transported to this location from a training exercise at the Norfolk Police Academy during which he began demonstrating serious neurological deficits. Not that he had neurological deficits that were developing over time, but on this occasion he began demonstrating serious neurological deficits. Upon evaluation, the medical record includes that he collapsed at the police academy. He was documented to have a Glasgow coma scale of 3. That means he was in a coma. And a CAT scan showed the bilateral subdural hematomas. Now, that shows that something bad happened to Mr. Kahn on the 9th of December.
Well, it shows that he started exhibiting these symptoms and had to be transported to a hospital, and the diagnosis was this hematoma and subdural hematoma. How is that admission as to what was the precipitating cause?
Because it is clearly an injury by accident.
But what admits that in this admission?
Beg your pardon?
What is the admission in this that says that what happened on the 9th was the precipitating cause?
That's not all there is to it. It is alleged in the complaint that all of these blows were the cause. I think causation is established by the complaint. But what is lacking in the allegations or the argument of Mr. Emmert is anything that shows any other injury by accident. And so I'm saying to you that a person could be developing a condition over time, just as is alleged here, and it might one day develop into a symptomatic condition that you would call a cumulative trauma injury. If this man had been sitting in the classroom taking an examination at the police academy and collapsed with the conditions that were found in him on the 9th of December, I wouldn't be able to say to you that there was an injury by accident. But in this case, it's very clear that there was an injury by accident because he was hit in the head, he collapsed, he had neurological deficits. He went to the hospital in a coma and had the hematoma. If you look at the...
That is probably your best argument, for sure.
That's the high water mark of my facts, except that I would supplement them with something that the plaintiff said in the brief that he filed asking for a jury trial on this case. And this is at page 15 of the appendix. As has been stated, the procedure was we filed a plea and bar. We came to be heard on that. They said they were entitled to a jury trial. The court entered an order saying that they would have a jury trial on the disputed facts, and then we moved for summary judgment when we got the discovery record established. But in their motion, in their memorandum supporting their motion for jury trial, this event of December 9 was characterized by them as saying, Officer Leldon Sapp repeatedly struck plaintiff's decedent in the head with his fists to the point where plaintiff's decedent was no longer able to defend himself from Officer Sapp. At this point, Officer Sapp suspended the attack, and shortly thereafter, Mr. Kahn was transported to Sentara Lee Hospital and then to Sentara Norfolk General Hospital. 9 days later, he died of trauma to the head.
But three paragraphs before that, he said that their investigation has identified 3 separate events during which plaintiff's decedent received severe traumatic blows to his head.
That's correct.
And in the request for admission, number 10 and actually 11 and 18 and several others, the same response is, it's a plaintiff's contention that the defendant cannot carry their burden of proof that the cause of Mr. Kahn's injuries was an identifiable incident or sudden precipitating event that resulted in an obvious sudden mechanical or structural change in the body. It seems to me if you take all of that together, there isn't any concession, there isn't any stipulation, and there isn't any admission that makes this issue something that is resolved.
Only by the evidence that I've described to you.
And that's what they say they'd like to have a jury decide.
But the purpose of the summary judgment motion is if there's no dispute. There's no dispute about these facts, about what happened to Mr. Connell on the 9th of December.
There's a dispute about causation.
I think that's established in the complaint. It's pled that these blows, among others, caused this. There is no other event of this type that occurred to him. This is an injury by accident. And I think it follows that if he had a pre-existing predisposition when he came to work that day because of earlier head blows, he's in the same position as any other person.
Why isn't this case like the A-Stop case? There the fellow was working in a lot of noxious fumes day after day. But finally one day they overcame him. He collapsed, as I understand it, or couldn't. It got worse, and at a time he became asphyxiated and suffocated and died. And after talking about a lot of case law, when we talk about, you know, no one event being the cause, we concluded instead, and this was on a demur in that case, that, in other words, the allegations there were broad enough to cover an event which may be actionable at law or one that may be compensable under the provisions of the Workers' Comp Act. Why isn't that exactly what we have here? We have a dispute about causation, whether what finally happened on the 9th was a result of what happened that day or whether it was the result of what happened over several days. That's disputed. Why doesn't a jury get to resolve that?
It's different than the A-Stroff case because in the A-Stroff case there was no identifiable injury by accident.
And he collapsed case, on that. He collapsed on a particular day and died.
The cases on cumulative injuries talk about the difference between the injury manifesting itself and what caused the injury. And the injury by accident is the cause. In a case like A-Stroff, there is no identifiable incident. Here we have one. That's the difference.
But in your view, A-Stroff is more like a carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cumulative effect. He has his exposure, but there's no identifiable incident. Having said that, in this case, your position would be there are identifiable incidents.
Yes.
And there are multiple ones.
Well,
if there are multiple ones, let's assume the case in the light that you have presented it. Does the jury get to decide that question?
Not without some evidence of an injury by accident that showed a sudden, obvious mechanical change in the body. My time is up. You want me to continue?
You may answer. You may answer.
The page of the brief that we've looked at and that you were referring me to only identifies three incidents. Two of them occurred on the 9th of December. And I've said in my brief, you know, we have to have an event that occurs within a discrete time, but it doesn't have to be a single blow. So those two didn't go together, the 9th of December, the 7th of December incident. It says that Mr. Kong told his classmates that he was injured and that he was having trouble seeing and he was having headaches. That's a separate workers' compensation injury, had it been brought to the attention of people that need to know about it. And so if he had a workers' compensation injury on the 7th, which was aggravated by what happened on the 9th, it's still workers' compensation. Does the court have any other questions for me?
I have one question. My understanding of your position is basically that there's an injury by accident, and there's a line of cases we have which begins with Berg versus Taniga, which talks about if the injury by accident contributed to a death, then it's compensable.
Yes.
And that's basically your position.
That is my position. And I think the fact that there was an injury by accident is established.
Okay.
I ask you to affirm the ruling below.
Thank you. Mr. Emmert.
Mr. Emmert, before you begin, let me ask you a couple questions about facts, whether or not they're disputed. Is there any dispute about Mr. Cone being injured on the 9th?
I don't think that there is a dispute about it.
Is there any dispute about whether or not his injury on the 9th contributed to his death?
We're not in a position to say that, whether he did or not.
So you say that's a question. You don't know whether that was a proximate cause of his death or not.
Correct. The hematomas could have developed after the blows on the 7th or on another day. We just don't know that.
All right.
There are a couple of discrete points that Mr. Ringer raised that I'd like to mention briefly before we conclude. The first is that he repeats the error that the trial court made and that he's now asking you to repeat when he says that what's lacking in our case is evidence of any other cause other than the ones that have been identified. This court's decision in the O'Brien case indicates that we're not required to develop in the discovery phase of the case all of the evidence in the case. That's a test for what goes on a trial. The trial court made that mistake at page A55 of the appendix. And as we correctly pointed out, I think, that on the page before, we're not required to anticipate these things. We're not required to fully put on all of our evidence. That would be the standard in federal court, but it doesn't apply in this court.
I'm sorry. What evidence are you saying that they are saying you should have put on?
I'm just quoting what Mr. Ringer said. He said that the only thing that what's lacking in our case is evidence of any indication of any injuries other than on the December the 9th. And in the O'Brien case, you said that litigants aren't required in responding to summary judgment to develop all their case. That would be true in federal court.
He said that, but I thought his point is that there's no dispute that there was an injury on the 9th.
I think that's a separate point that he made.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The second thing is that the trial court in this case reasoned that the last blow must have caused the death in this case. You'll find that in, I think, page 53 of the appendix when she asked me a question in that argument. The question becomes, if you'll permit me the luxury of a hypothetical question, how could she know that? Because that's the kind of thing that requires medical testimony. Causation is inherently a medical question. That's page 54 of the appendix where we pointed that out to the court.
Mr. Emmerich, does it boil down to this, and maybe I'm paraphrasing it incorrectly, you can certainly tell me. We don't know it yet. We don't know at this point whether he would have collapsed on December the 9th even if he had not been hit at all that day.
That's exactly correct. And that's what we tried in vain to reason to the trial court. Okay. Because he may well have been injured on the 7th and that gradually developed.
It would have collapsed anyway.
And collapsed anyway. He may have been injured in November or some other date. On paragraph 11 on page 3 of the appendix, we allege that on various and sundry days between September 20 and December 9, he sustained blows. And that creates a dispute of fact. In this case, unless the court is prepared to make two major changes, one in the law relating to cumulative trauma and the other with regard to summary judgment, this case has to be reversed. There needs to be a trial here.
I guess the big question seems to be when it goes back on a trial, what are the interrogatories that are going to be placed before that jury that's going to hear the plea and bar? And what do you believe are the questions of fact that need to be answered by that jury?
Well, I'd hesitate to craft a special interrogatory on the fly while I'm standing here. But generally speaking, it would be asking the jury if they find, based upon the evidence in the case, that death resulted from a single identifiable act.
But that's not the workers' compensation standard, because on the plea and bar, what we're dealing with is workers' compensation, right?
Right.
And whether or not it would be applicable. And our cases have said that, one, I guess, it seems like, is there an injury by accident? And then there would be a question as to whether or not what happened on January the 9th, December the 9th, is an injury by accident. Then the next question would be whether or not that injury by accident contributed to the defendant's death.
I understand.
And that's wrong.
Yes. So. And given the body of case law that this court has laid down, I think it's quite possible to craft an appropriate set of instructions for the jury that tells them exactly what the parameters of an injury by accident are. I don't
right.
have any doubt about that.
Right.
Since my time is up, I would thank you for your interest in the issues of this case and for your courtesy to me.
Thank you. Call the next case.